from the Moen Broadcast Center. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. For nearly 2 years, many Democratic lawmakers urged patience. Give the special counsel time to finish his investigation into the Trump campaign. Now Mueller is out with his report, but most prominent Democrats are staying cautious. They're not calling for impeachment proceedings against the president. What's the political calculation? That's coming up on Air Talk. Welcome to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. I want to make a note on the top of the show that we are following updates on the deadly Easter bombings in Sri Lanka. They've killed 300 people so far, close to 300, that is. And we will be covering that story in depth next hour with news and analysis on what happened and some historical context for past violence in that country. And that's all coming up at 11 today. First, though, last week we learned from Special Counsel Robert Mueller that the Trump campaign was happy to accept help from Russia to gain an advantage in the 2016 election. And the Mueller report included firsthand accounts of President Trump asking members of his administration to impede the Russia investigation and then to lie about their actions. This all feels like a big deal. For some, it's a vindication, however, of the president's no collusion refrain. The president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, went so far as to say taking information from Russians was just fine.
There's nothing wrong with taking information from Russians.
There's nothing wrong with taking
information. It depends on where it came from. You're assuming that the giving of information is a campaign contribution. You read the report carefully. Mm-hmm. The report says we can't conclude that because the law is pretty much against that. People get information from this person, that person.
So you would have accepted information from Russians against a client, against a candidate, if you were running in the presidential election?
I probably wouldn't. I wasn't asked. I would have advised, just out of excess of caution, don't do it.
And Giuliani was speaking with CNN's Jake Tapper there. For others, it's proof, the Mueller report, that it's time to take serious action to try to remove President Trump from office. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is, of course, running for president, spoke about this at a campaign rally on Saturday.
We have a constitution of the United States, and it says when a president engages in this kind of activity, then it's time for impeachment. Sure. For me, this is not about politics. There are some decisions that are bigger than politics. I finished that report late into the night Thursday. I guess it was sometime early on Friday. And looked up and realized that Mueller has laid it all out and handed it to Congress for Congress to take action.
So 2 years waiting for the report, but that conversation is just getting started. I want to dive in with our weekly political roundtable here on Air Talk. Amanda Renteria joins me now. She's chair of Emerge America, a national organization that works to identify and train Democratic women who want to run for political office. And Renteria is also the former national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Welcome, Amanda. Thank you very much for being on Air Talk today.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line is Pete Peterson, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine University. Welcome, Dean Peterson. I really love talking with you on Air Talk. It's great to have you back.
Great to be back.
So, Amanda, I'll start with you to set the table. The Mueller report is finally out in a redacted version. What do you consider to be the most important takeaways from what this team of investigators found? Do you think that it will have any serious political consequences for the president or his party?
You know, as I read through it over the weekend, I think the concentration has been on volume two, really is the actions about obstruction of justice. And it is quite incredible how much was laid out, 11 different instances that Special Counsel Mueller laid out. And I think that is where I believe Congress will start. And I want to start with, you know, when he said Congress has the authority to protect official proceedings, including those of courts and grand juries, from corrupt, obstructive acts, regardless of their source. That piece of the report, the fact that he wrote that in there, is a reminder about what is Congress's authority and how do we ensure that public institutions survive these moments of chaos and controversy. And here is a real test to Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, about what to do now.
At the same time, Amanda, notably, the special counsel did not come to a conclusion on the obstruction question. We're going to talk about his motivations soon on why he didn't come to that conclusion. But if we don't have, you know, an official in the legal, in the Justice Department, that is, saying this was obstruction, can the House justify starting an impeachment proceeding?
Sure. So as laid out by Mueller, what he said was there is no motive around a crime because in his summary, a crime was not committed, but there could very well be other motives. And in fact, as you read through the report, he actually provided a couple, whether that was credibility issues, legitimacy issues, and actually pointed out some key statements made by the president about the worry that more of the ties and connections to Russia would actually harm his credibility. And so there are quite a few motives to follow for Congress to follow up on as they move forward.
And also on the line with us, Pete Peterson from Pepperdine University. What do you take away from the Mueller report? Just top lines so far, Pete, and what do you think the political consequences will be for the president?
Well, for me, the top line is actually the expansiveness of the Russian operations to influence the 2016 elections. Page 23 of the report talks about that Facebook had estimated that the Russian influence peddling operation had reached as many as 126 million persons through their Facebook accounts. That Twitter had identified 3,800 Russian-controlled Twitter accounts and notified approximately 1.4 million people through those different accounts. And so I know obviously the focus is on the president and whether this is going towards impeachment in the House. But to me, the thing that really jumps out is really how significant and expansive the Russian online operations were to attempt to influence voters. And at the same time, there doesn't seem to be, I'm sure these things are happening, but there doesn't seem to be a big conversation about what we're going to do next year.
It feels like they're happening on the local level, Pete, but yeah. I don't know that we've had that federal conversation, you know, to talk about the wider efforts to, A, educate people to not be manipulated by social media, to have the platforms address this on their end, and the efforts at hacking, the making sure that our election systems are secure. But do you think that part of that was an unwillingness by the president to accept that there was this massive attack by Russia because it cast doubt on his election win?
I think that's totally true. I do believe that's certainly a contributing factor. I don't think it's the only one. I believe we do have intelligence services that are working on these issues no matter what the president says. But I do think that's a factor. I thought Maureen Dowd, actually, I'm not always a great fan of her writing, but I think she had a pretty powerful column in the New York Times over the weekend in which much of what comes out in the Mueller report is the president's anger over the fact that the influence, the understood Russian influence, might in some way diminish his accomplishment in winning the 2016 election. And so I do believe that's certainly a contributing factor. But no matter what the president does, there's a national intelligence operation that the country runs, and I hope is looking into this. And I hope companies like Facebook and Twitter, obviously they've taken steps just in the last year to try to make sure this doesn't happen again, but also to even understand that Russia's not the only player here. I'm sure that China and other countries are engaged in these types of subterfuge and are attempting to influence the 2020 race.
I want to return to one of the passages. He comes back to it quite often, actually, in the report, that Robert Mueller described his decision-making in the second part of the report on obstruction. And Amanda Renteria, I'll ask you to weigh in on this first. And I'm relying on some Washington Post summarizing and excerpts here when I read to you. The redacted Mueller report released last week, it makes clear that Mueller's team viewed the Office of Legal Counsel opinion, the Justice Department opinion, to mean that they also could not come to a conclusion about whether the president had committed a crime because it would violate Justice Department standards of fairness to make such an accusation. So a president can't be indicted or said to have committed a crime because the president will not be able to take the stand, will not be able to engage in a legal defense while he's in office. That person, whoever's accused of being a criminal while they're the president, would not have a chance to fight that accusation. But Bill Barr, when he released a letter summarizing the Mueller report and also spoke ahead of the Mueller report's redacted release in a press conference, he suggested that Mueller based his decision to not come to a decision on obstruction not just on the OLC opinion and whether or not they would have found a crime. So basically, there was there were other reasons other than the OLC opinion that Mueller did not come down one way or the other on obstruction. And Barr said that he was, said several times that he was not taking a position, not just because of the OLC opinion. It just feels so muddled, Amanda. Why do you think Mueller decided to pass on this? And do you think that it was an abdication of his special counsel responsibility? Because in the vacuum, we saw Bill Barr step up and make that determination.
Right. Well, what Bill Barr did was unprecedented. So I don't know whether Mueller was thinking that would happen, considering it's incredibly rare, in fact, not done, that the AG or anyone does a press conference before the report is out. So it's probably difficult for Mueller to see that. But when you actually read the report, what you can read in there is Mueller is very clear about what his prerogative is, what he is doing. And when he says, listen, I cannot weigh in on obstruction of justice, that is congressional authority. And I, right now, as special counsel, I report to the Justice Department. That delineation, as you read through the report, is incredibly clear. And so what Attorney General Barr did was unusual. And, frankly, the report hadn't been out, so he didn't answer some of those tough early questions that I'm sure journalists and reporters would have been asking, which is, what do you have to say about Volume 2? What do you have to say about Mueller's response to, there are certain things I cannot do, and in fact, I leave those to Congress to take it from here?
Is having Robert Mueller testify before Congress the only way to really decipher this, Pete Peterson with Pepperdine?
Well, I certainly think they're going to try to make that case. I think it's worth backing up here also to say that collusion, that there is a separation here between the possibility of collusion and conspiracy and these other elements. It's directly stated in the report, and now I have it up in front of me on page 181 in the section on potential coordination, conspiracy, and collusion, that the investigation did not establish that the contacts described in Volume 1, Section 4 amounted to an agreement to commit any substantive violation of federal criminal law, including foreign influence and campaign finance laws, both of which are discussed further below. The office, therefore, did not charge any individual associated with the Trump campaign with conspiracy to commit a federal offense arising from Russia contacts, either under a specific statute or under Section 371's offenses clause. Now, that is also connected to the last section in the document. In fact, the conclusion on page 394, which is that all-important sentence that we've referenced before, based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him, the last sentence in the entire document. And so that still, it does open up that door towards Congress now picking up what they believe is a baton and moving towards the prospect of an impeachment process. I would say that I think most of the Democratic leadership, and I do mean the leadership, whether it's Pelosi or others.
Steny Hoyer has spoken, yeah.
Right. They've been measured in their statement about what they think should come next. And they think hearings should come next before there's ever a discussion of impeachment. And I think that's wise to be moving in that direction as opposed to throwing the long ball, as obviously a presidential candidate like Senator Warren would.
Yeah, I want to talk about 2020 candidates in just a second. But first, just to the clip that we played in the intro, Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, spoke to Meet the Press and also CNN's Jake Tapper, saying that pretty much the acceptance of information from WikiLeaks as a front for Russia and also the offers of help from Russia that were taken in by Jared Kushner and Don Jr., those were fine because, and Giuliani's reasoning includes that the public had the right to know information about what the DNC was saying in emails and Hillary Clinton's campaign. Are we normalizing at this point? I'll take Pete Peterson's response first. The idea of a foreign power helping a presidential campaign, is that something that will be happening in the future? Because it appears the special counsel cleared the president on this issue of conspiracy, and the president's supporters are going out there saying it's fine, and any other campaign would have done it also.
Well, I think to the clip that you played before, what Giuliani is saying is that there's nothing wrong with somebody from another country presenting information that might be used in a campaign. Where it becomes collusion or conspiracy is when that's seen as being directly tied to a foreign government. Let us not forget that the so-called Steele dossier was essentially paid for by the DNC as well as the Hillary Clinton campaign, also utilized what is named in that at least background of the document as so-called Kremlin sources. So on that side of the aisle, too, and I know that there's Congressman Nunez wants to open up or is opening up some hearings on where that document came from. I think it's fair to say that the Clinton campaign, as well as the DNC, has their hands pretty dirty in this, in looking at where they were getting some of their opposition research and their ties to sources inside the Kremlin.
To be fair, we kind of litigated this, though, right? And the Steele dossier was funded as opposition research, partly by Democrats, but was begun in the first place with funding from opposition within the Republican Party. And didn't we go over this with the Nunes memo and everything that, you know, this investigation did not rely on the Steele dossier alone? I mean, this is not, you know, is the Steele dossier
still relevant?
Oh, no,
and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that the Steele dossier, as some on my side of the aisle, was the only impetus and the trigger for the broader investigation. I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, to your earlier question about are we normalizing the use of information from foreign entities to help influence elections or collect opposition research? That happened on the other side of the aisle, I think, in certainly more significant ways than, say, the June 9th meeting at Trump Towers or several of the other issues or connections that are raised here in the Mueller report.
Amanda Renteria, your response to the issue of foreign help and what Pete Peterson raised about the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Sure. Let's go to the very clear point that no presidential candidate should ever be working with a foreign enemy in order to get information, whether it's helpful to you or not. At that very moment, that should have been reported to the FBI, and nothing was ever reported. So let me start there. The second piece is any campaign official that is involved in working with a foreign enemy for information should be questioned. And if there's anyone on the Clinton campaign that has done that, they also should be questioned. And trust me, I suspect they would, given the vast, expansive process that has been gone through, that has gone through the special counsel has gone through. But when you dive even deeper into this, it's not simply that it wasn't reported to the FBI, but that the president was actually engaged in making sure that that press statement about the Trump Tower, that the press statement actually kept people out, told his staff to keep people out of the discussion, made some very clear changes to that press statement about who and who was there and who wasn't there and what was discussed. That kind of information, we need one clear message from our United States government that no one, No one, the president or any staff, should be working with foreign enemies for information, even if it is helpful to your campaign.
Amanda, do you think that this ultimately moves the needle at all with voters? There is this perception that everyone's sort of in their corners. There is a dwindling number of truly swing voters. And most people have made up their mind about what they think about this president and his relationship with the law and with ethics, and that the opinions about the Mueller report, now that we have the redacted version, aren't really going to change very much from what we thought over the last couple years since this president was inaugurated. Does this truly make any ripples with actual voters and people that will decide the 2020 race?
So I think we are in I think there's some truth to the reality. This has been going on for 2 years now. People have their set opinions on it. I think that is true. Is this report going to change much of that? Probably not. What I do think it does, however, is at this moment of truth, how do people respond to now what do you do, right? Particularly senators and congressmen who are sitting in office and may have to have a vote on impeachment. What do they do at that moment of truth? Do they look at this that vote or this process as beyond themselves? In other words, there's a real question here for Democrats as they move forward with this, which is perhaps this isn't about a presidential campaign, but instead about understanding our public institutions and making sure that at the end of this entire investigation, that making sure our public institutions are still as strong as ever and that people trust them again. And that's a question that I think every single presidential candidate will go through. But in any one given 30 days of a polling cycle, will you see a change in what the electorate thinks? No, probably not. I actually think people's opinions are pretty set. And so I'm not sure that's the question, though, that candidates are asking themselves right now.
Pete Peterson, do you think that there is anyone out there who maybe was thinking about shopping around for, a Democratic candidate? They voted for Trump last time around, and this really pushed them over the fence. Or do you think that there hasn't been a major change so far? It's only been a few days, I realize.
Yeah, I think we're still early on, and I think it is going to depend on the steps that the democratically controlled Congress takes from here on out. If Mueller is subpoenaed and brought to D.C. to talk, depending on what he said, that certainly could make a difference. There are so many moving parts to this, but to the question about where we stand today, I think most of this has been. Most of the opinion about what we have seen through this is now being seen through such partisan lenses that I think it frankly hardens those who are supporters of Trump, and also hardens those who are against the president. So, as it stands today, I don't see really much of a difference in public opinion.
We saw Elizabeth Warren, the clip I played in the intro, speaking on Saturday, and she was on television, I believe, on Friday, even calling for the House to begin impeachment proceedings. So far, I haven't seen any other prominent 2020 candidates stepping out and making that kind of a statement, making that kind of a imploring to her House colleagues to actually begin the process. What's the calculation there? Pete Peterson first, in terms of 2020 candidates who certainly are no fans of President Trump, but don't seem eager to step out on impeachment.
Yeah, well, if I'm Nancy Pelosi and I hear statements like that from a senator, I say, easy for you to say.
Yeah.
In the Senate, this isn't something that you really have to take a lead on. It's a decision, set of decisions that Congressman Nadler and also certainly Speaker Pelosi are the ones going to have to make the decisions. I did hear over the weekend that another candidate, Julian Castro, has also come out and demanded that impeachment proceedings proceed. But I think the fact that we have not heard of the what is soon to be 20 Democratic candidates, that we have not seen others be more vocal in their support of impeachment proceedings, really does speak to where they perceive public opinion to be, and a willingness to actually let this process work itself out. If the speaker were to come forward at some point this week or next and say, she is on the record as saying, and I believe this is a direct quotation, that the president isn't worth impeaching. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see how Congress moves forward here in these next couple of weeks.
Amanda Renteria, Nancy Pelosi, master of the polite shade being cast in the political arena. Democrats, as you know, they didn't win the House by hammering on the Russia investigation. I mean, they won by talking about health care and not a ton else. The economy in Southern California, issues like child separation had some resonance. Some say that trying for impeachment would only strengthen this sense of grievance among Trump supporters and possibly motivate them in 2020. Is the impeachment issue, in your opinion, a loser for Democrats in 2020?
I believe you can do two things at once. It is certain that Democratic candidates have got to talk. They just must talk about what they are for. I think a lot of the lessons learned in 2018 is you're absolutely right. As you go across the country and you look in a lot of these districts, particularly moderate districts, what you saw is folks talking about health care, folks talking about what was important to their communities. And I think you're going to see that as in terms of what the presidential candidates need to and will do. However, I also think that at a moment in our country's history, there are a lot of Democratic leaders who will read the full text of this report. And at the end of it, it's going to be very difficult to think that it's now time to close the door and walk away. Every other congressional candidate in the or not a candidate, every other member of Congress throughout our history in moments like this, whether it was President Clinton, whether it was President Nixon, they all decided that it was an important point that the Congress continue their process going forward and decide what to do. In those cases, they obviously had an impeachment vote, but it's hard to get to the end of this report, I've got to say, and see those 11 different clauses that Special Counsel Mueller put out there and say, okay, now we should close the door and move to the next chapter. And I think every single member of Congress will go through that, and candidates will go through it in a different way, making sure that they talk about what they are for while these proceedings continue.
Yeah, you mentioned the Clinton impeachment, and it does feel like a lifetime ago, although based on sneaker styles and jean cuts, it maybe could just be last week. there was this, you know, big conversation going on similar to today, not in the issues really addressed in the Starr report versus the Mueller report, but in terms of whether to impeach or not. And this is a clip that has gone viral on Twitter since the Mueller report was released last week. And it's Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking on the House floor. And this is 1999.
So the point I'm trying to make is you don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
Amanda, he makes a pretty good case there. Is there a moral imperative for Democrats? You kind of touched on this. If Democrats truly believe that President Trump, based on this report, is unfit for office, despite the inevitability that the Senate will never convict, is it a moral imperative to go ahead with impeachment?
And that's the question. I mean, I believe there's a true congressional responsibility to go through the proceedings. The question will be, as you go through that, as you go through the hearings, as you go through understanding more of what happened, as Special Counsel Mueller perhaps testifies, I think that will lead to whether or not you have a vote or not. You know, John Dean, lawyer during the Nixon time frame, put it, the endeavor to obstruct justice is the crime. And I think that is going to be a real question and a process that Congress needs to go through. And then we'll see where Senator Graham is after that process.
Pete Peterson with Pepperdine. I'm sorry for putting you in the time machine back to the 90s. But any thoughts about this idea that there's like a moral imperative in front of Congress if these Democrats are going to say we truly believe that this president committed obstruction? Must they go ahead and kind of put their money where their mouth is and start impeachment?
You know, that phrase, moral imperative, is extremely difficult to define in these instances. I do disagree that with John Dean that the endeavor to obstruct is the crime in and of itself. I mean, I think John's been pretty a pretty vocal critic of the president for a couple years now. So I'm not surprised by that statement. And it's not really based in any sort of constitutional fact. That's not to say that it can't be interpreted that way. And I would say that Mueller quite skillfully, as I quoted from before, just from the conclusion of the document, left the door open for Democrats to pursue further investigations. From a political standpoint, just to respond to an earlier question, I do see it's going to be extremely problematic for Democrats. It is, you know, possible that you, as I often hear from Democrats who support moving forward with impeachment proceedings, that they can, quote, walk and chew gum at the same time. But this will be such a consuming process if, as we learned in the late 90s, if the Democrats continue to move forward with specific impeachment proceedings. And also still it needs to move forward through the Senate as well. And so, again, I think the door is open for Democrats. I think that they do have an opportunity and information in this report to at least hold hearings on next step, to call Mueller to D.C. But if a step is taken out of this report and nothing new really is learned through committee hearings, I think that's going to be a real it's going to be politically beneficial, frankly, to the president.
Pete Peterson, I know the media does a little too much navel gazing and a little too much talking about itself sometimes, but there was one episode in the Mueller report that really stung, I think, reporters who have been doggedly trying to find the facts about this president and about what has occurred over the last couple of years. And that was when Sarah Huckabee Sanders, two Mueller's investigators, said that she had lied to reporters after FBI Director James Comey was fired, when she claimed that, quote, countless FBI agents had told her they were happy about the firing because they had lost confidence in Comey. That was not true. Sanders said that it wasn't based on anything to investigators. She's now saying that it was more of a slip of the tongue in public, you know, that there's no culture of dishonesty in the White House briefing room. But I just think back to that conversation where reporters were challenging her on the Comey firing, and she's coming up with a justification or coming up with an anecdote that's completely based on nothing, as she admitted. Has she lost legitimacy as a conduit for this president?
Well, I think that's going to be a difficult thing to rebuild. I know that other lies have been told that relationships and trust can be rebuilt. I do think it is important to consider what specifically she was saying and in what context. That doesn't mean that it wasn't a lie, but it does mean that I think the specifics of the decision to fire Comey didn't just rest on what Sanders said. There were a lot of other reasons. In fact, reasons that many Democrats in Congress and the Senate were also calling for Comey's firing as well.
So, leading up to the 2016 election, his announcement about Hillary Clinton, and right.
And so I think it is a fair thing to call for her firing. I do think that it is that admitting that you did not tell the truth and you are the press spokesperson, that person is meant to communicate and argue for the president, but to do it truthfully. So I don't think that there's I think it's a fair thing to call for. But am I going to be very disappointed if she doesn't step down and stays at her post? It's really not a big deal to me.
Pete Peterson, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine University. And also Amanda Renteria is with us, Chair of Emerge America, a national organization that works to identify and train Democratic women who want to run for political office. They're both joining me in our politics roundtable here on Monday's Air Talk. I'm Libby Dankman, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Much more after the break, including Joe Biden's impending announcement. We believe he's going to announce this week at least. And much more right after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Hey there, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle today. Larry will be back tomorrow. Amanda Renteria joins me for our politics roundtable. She's chair of Emerge America. And Pete Peterson also on the line with the School of Public Policy at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine University. Moving to the 2020 race, Joe Biden expected to release a video announcement for his presidential run on Wednesday. Despite not jumping in yet, Biden is really leading the other frontrunner, Senator Bernie Sanders, in most early polls. There are some rumblings that his operation is maybe a little disorganized. It's unclear where he's going to be speaking for the next few weeks. There is some conversation about the fact that he is announcing 3 weeks into the second fundraising quarter, so maybe the timing is a little questionable. Amanda, is the Democratic electorate clamoring for Joe Biden to get in? What do you make of his late announcement?
I think the Democratic Party is very much engaged in really having a broad candidate spectrum, and he will add to it, no doubt. I think any polls at this point are so early, and it's really about name recognition. And of course, the former vice president has quite a bit of name recognition. And so all those polls that say Biden should be coming in, I think you have to make sure you're discounting for the fact that it's a name people know, but not necessarily clamoring for any real bend. And as I talk to a lot of the electorate, people really are taking their time to understand where each of the candidates are and really want to see them grow in this process of a primary.
What about the criticism that came out from some Democratic electeds and former electeds? Lucy Flores, a Nevada politician, talked about this uncomfortable physicality that Joe Biden has had with some women. She said that he crossed a line, but was clear that she didn't feel that she was being sexually harassed, but she was made to feel uncomfortable. In the wake of this, he's cracked a couple light jokes publicly about this issue. Do you think that this is simply not going to stick to him, that Joe Biden, you know, will acknowledge this and kind of move on and not have any issues with Me Too or the conversation about physicality going forward?
It's going to be really important for him to be ready to answer that, and not just once, but many times. My experience on the presidential campaign is how many times you answer questions over and over again when people have concerns. And this was one of them. Certainly, you know, I think he couldn't do that before jumping in. But right when he jumps in, there's going to be an expectation that he has a clear answer to that, and that he continues to give people comfort in knowing that whether it was his intentions or really just how he answers that will be very much reviewed over and over again.
Yeah, Pete Peterson, what else do you take away from Joe Biden? I know it's not really late in terms of the calendar and the cycle for 2020, but considering there's almost 20 candidates in the race already, and there was a lot of speculation about whether the former vice president would ever jump in, what do you make about his timing and his positioning in these early, early polls?
Well, I think it's your bumper music leading into this section. I don't know if that was De La Soul or A Tribe Called Quest. And it reminds me back from the 80s and 90s.
I'm going to have to get a confirmation from our engineer on that one. I will get back to you.
But I thought it quite appropriate. I mean, it's just amazing that many of my friends who are Democrats, who are more moderate in their political persuasion, have been waiting for this moment when Biden would jump in. And when I have conversations on it, I think sometimes we forget really how truly bad of a political candidate he was. This obviously is not going to be his first time stepping into running for president of the United States. And the last couple were pretty dismal failures. And the fact that many Democrats, at least, again, those that may define themselves more as moderates, have really see him as being the person who's going to save the Democratic Party here heading into a possible general election fight against the president. But again, I think sometimes we forget that he really was not a great candidate. And some of the ways that he has handled, to your very good point, Libby, I mean, almost making a couple offhand smirks or jokes about some of the accusations about him touching women. That's just not going to fly in 2019 and into 2020. And so he's going to have to come up with some better answers. And but I can see him making more than a few gaffes, because that's really who he is. It'll be interesting to see where the opposition is going to come from, especially from the more progressive wing of the party.
Yeah, we do have a 19th Democrat who made it official. Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton has jumped in. He's an Iraq War veteran. He was first elected in 2014. Plans to run a campaign based on national security issues. He's one of several veterans that are running on the Democratic side. Of course, Mayor Pete, Tulsi Gabbard. Moulton previously tried to unseat Nancy Pelosi in House leadership. He couldn't really find anyone willing to run against her for the speaker's gavel. He will be in California on Friday. He's kind of making that tour of early primary and caucus states. Amanda Renteria, what do you make of the field so far? Do we think that Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton will make any kind of a splash? Is it just too early? I mean, there's just so many people. All we have is these early polls and fundraising numbers. Before the debates, can we really tell anything at this point?
No, I mean, it's incredibly early. But frankly, for somebody like Congressman Moulton, he does need to be out there now, because people do need to get to know him since he's a new name. What I think is interesting to see emerging is you do see veterans coming to the forefront. You do see a conversation more around foreign policy in a way that's been really elevated in the Democratic Party. And, I think that's what's been great about this primary process, is everyone comes with a different angle, a different bio. And the long term of this process allows you to tell your story and then talk about the policy issues as debates start. And so everything right now is way too early. And one of the things when people say Biden is a little bit late, well, in some ways, people do know him. So he doesn't need the long trail of who are you and why are you in this? On the other hand, he needs to have that time to make sure that he can actually account for all of his past votes and why he's in the race now and what's happened in the past. So this is going to be a long race and a really engaged one from what I'm seeing in the electoral, the Democratic electorate.
Amanda Renteria with Emerge America and Pete Peterson with Pepperdine University, both joining me on the Politics Roundtable on Air Talk. We're going to take a quick break and come back. There's a big Supreme Court case starting tomorrow about the census and the question of whether to ask about citizenship on the census. And also, 100 days in office for Governor Gavin Newsom. How's he doing so far? We're going to ask our politics guests all of that coming up next, right after a quick break here on Air Talk. Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Amanda Renteria with Emerge America and Pete Peterson of Pepperdine University also joining me. The Supreme Court will begin hearing arguments tomorrow about the addition of a citizenship question to the 2020 census. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross has argued the question will help protect minority voting rights, whereas many states like California and civil liberties groups like the ACLU have argued that the question will sow fear with immigrant communities and drive them underground, resulting in an undercount of millions of people. Pete Peterson, up first, why is the Trump administration intent on this court battle? What is important about this going to the Supreme Court, and what do you make of the makeup of this court, considering it has two Trump appointees now making decisions?
Well, I think this is just part of a broader set of arguments that the president is and the administration are making thematically about citizenship and what they view to be, and certainly what the president argues to be, that we have lost control of our borders, that we don't have a true sense of who's living in the country. And obviously the census is used in part to designate and apportion federal funds to states and into programs, depending on how many people are living in states and in the country more broadly. And their belief that money may be going to those who are not in the country legally. I think it's fair to say that the argument mostly put forth by those on the left, that that kind of question would depress those who are in the country legally from answering the census, is a fair argument. I don't think it puts things into the millions, as many on the left have argued, that it would depress legal citizen minority participants in the survey by millions.
I've seen over 6 million is the estimate on.
Yeah, and I just don't see that. Again, it's one of those things that the president is way far too out, way over his skis on this. But I think the response is too far over the skis as well. So I honestly don't see this as being a major issue as it relates to the quality of the census. But I also, if I were being asked by the president, although I don't think he would ever ask me a question, but if he would, I just think this is a stupid hill to fight on.
And the quality of the census that you mentioned, it's so important. I mean, it has to do with billions of dollars in federal funding, the spending on supplemental nutrition assistance program, for example, in California, SNAP. It provides food stamps to nearly 9% of households in LA County. We're talking about apportioning seats in Congress, people that, you know, drawing the boundaries of congressional districts. It's just a huge amount of information and valuable data that's used for all sorts of things in government.
Yep.
Amanda Renteria, what do you make of the Supreme Court taking this up, the Trump administration being eager to have this go to the highest court, and the makeup of this court and what it'll mean for this fight?
Well, let me start off by saying, you know, I grew up in Tulare County. My dad is actually from Mexico. So the idea that this isn't a big deal on the ground, or that people are still going to fill out government forms at a time when immigrant communities feel completely under attack since this president has come into office, I think to believe this is not a big deal or it's not reaching the millions is a statement of probably not coming to my neighborhood or my community where I grew up, because I can tell you the fear of what's happening on the ground is real. And any numbers that indicate that folks are feeling scared is real. And so do I think it's going to be in the 6 million? I don't know the exact number, but it's certainly not insignificant. And the reason that really matters is because it is what determines funds for these communities. It is what determines food stamps, et cetera. You can go through all the different federal programs that in California will be affected really most. 27% of our population is foreign born. Not only does it affect the actual funds that come here, but it affects the empowerment in these communities and what immigrants have been doing for the state of California and our country for a long period of time. And so for me, as I look at this and what's happened to the Supreme Court and even the dialogue that we are having right now about whether or not this should be a question, is in and of itself hurting our communities as we speak. And so it's unfortunate that that's where we are. It's unfortunate that people forget the history of America as a country of immigrants. And so my hope is that justices will think back to where our country was founded and the words we used in our Constitution to make sure that we are counting all people who are here.
Just because we're running short on time, I want to move on really quickly. It's obviously an incredibly important discussion, the census, and we will be tracking that fully on KPCC and on NPR. But Governor Gavin Newsom has been serving about 100 days in office. Since he took office in Sacramento, you know, he's tackled issues like prescription drug pricing, Medi-Cal expansion for undocumented immigrants. Early childhood education has been a big issue area for him. Maybe the most high profile policy position has been his moratorium on the death penalty in California. Pete Peterson, first up, what do you make of Gavin Newsom's first 100 days and his policy agenda going forward?
Well, I think it's fair to say that what we saw for the most part on the campaign is what we're seeing now with a Governor Newsom. I think his greatest battle is, and I know some folks who were working in the administration, is how do we hold intention, especially around issues related to housing and economic policy. What we haven't seen, we've heard some talk about housing policy, which was really one of his major issues that he ran on, how that connects to environmental policy, because in that there really are, again, within the administration, I think two different wings of the Democratic Party more broadly playing out regarding how are we going to grow as a state and if we are going to grow as a state. And so I think the decision, the moratorium on the death penalties, was actually something that he did not run on. I think it was really mostly, for the most part, symbolic. But what remains to be seen is how we are going to respond to what I really believe is the major issue in the state today, which is opportunity for those in the lower and middle classes, and especially the role that housing costs play in that opportunity.
And we have about a minute left. Amanda Renteria, former gubernatorial candidate yourself, can you assess the first 100 days of this governor, and what do you make of his platform and priorities going forward?
Yeah, I think he covered a lot of ground in these first 100 days, and I agree with Pete. I think the housing issue and the way he's handled that will be a real mark of his administration, and we're going to see more to come there.
Amanda Renteria with Emerge America, a national organization that works to identify and train Democratic women who want to run for political office. And Pete Peterson, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine University. Thank you both so much for joining me today on Air Talk and joining our political roundtable and really hashing out all these issues. I really appreciate it. And both of you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks for having
so much.
Me.
It's Libby Denkman. I'm in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk today. Coming up after the news, we are going to discuss what's happened in Sri Lanka, the terrible attacks on Easter Sunday, and the implications for that country's balance of religious minorities. It's all coming up after the news. Thanks for being with us on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Easter Sunday was a time for the Christian minority in Sri Lanka to gather at churches to celebrate one of the most holy days on their calendar. But those observances were violently disrupted by one of the worst terror attacks globally in the past 5 years. Nearly 300 people are dead and hundreds more wounded after multiple suicide bombings at places of worship and hotels in Sri Lanka. And the government has now named a group it believes was responsible for these devastating attacks. For more, we turn to Emily Schmall, a correspondent covering South Asia for the Associated Press. And she's in Sri Lanka reporting on the attacks. Hi, Emily. Can you tell me where exactly you are reporting from today?
Yes. Hi. I am in Sri Lanka's capital of Colombo, and I have been in central Colombo all day.
And I understand that you arrived yesterday in country. What have you seen and heard since you got to Sri Lanka? How are people dealing with these attacks? I'm sure that there's a ton of emotion and people in the streets just trying to grapple with what's happened.
Actually, the streets have been eerily quiet. And it began yesterday, even before the government enforced its first curfew, and really continued today, hours before a second curfew was enforced, in an area of the city that's usually really busy with tourists, where there are lots of restaurants and shops and places to buy souvenirs. There was virtually no one out for much of the day, except for these armed guards just sort of standing on street corners. So it was quite odd. But other parts of the city, particularly around St. Anthony's Shrine, which was one of the stricken churches on Sunday, people were out and about and consoling one another, talking about what had happened, and ultimately fleeing when a van that had three bombs attached to it suddenly exploded. Fortunately, no one was injured, but it certainly rattled a lot of people here.
Yeah, that is remarkable and potentially so devastating on top of the attacks that happened on Easter Sunday. It is past 11 o'clock in Sri Lanka right now. I know it's late for you. I understand that you mentioned one of the other explosions that have been occurring. Have you heard any of these? I understand that the police are actually defusing some devices, so some explosions can be heard around Colombo and other parts of Sri Lanka.
I haven't personally heard any of the devices being detonated. Actually, in the case of this van that had been parked since Sunday, just near the shrine that was attacked, the police had come after residents had sort of complained that there was a suspicious van that had been there since the attacks. And police approached, they discovered these three cylinders that they soon realized were bombs. And as they were attempting to defuse them, the bombs instead detonated. And fortunately, nobody was injured. But I think, as I said, it did cause quite a scare. But from where I was, several blocks away, I did not hear it.
Hmm. So what happened on Easter Sunday? Can you take us back and describe this series of coordinated attacks that took so many lives?
Yes. So from what we can tell, and really this is a very fluid story, it's been a case where officials from different agencies and different levels of government have chimed in at various times. So it's been sort of a puzzle piecing it all together. But from our reporting, there were six near simultaneous bombings at three churches and three pretty high-end hotels. The hotels were all located in Colombo, as was St. Anthony's Shrine. And all four of those places are quite popular with tourists. At the same time, two other bombs went off, or two other explosions took place in two other Christian churches on Colombo's outskirts. And it was early morning, between 7 and 8 a.m. And from what witnesses and survivors have told us, these places were packed. I think those of us who, sometimes only occasionally go to church for holidays know what it's like to try to enter a church on one of these major feast days, because the pews were full. People were standing in the back. People were standing even outside in one case. And so there were several hundred people in each of these areas. So when the bombs went off, the effect was really, really devastating. And immediately just terror reigned. People witnessed really, really traumatic things, described seeing bodies sort of taken out of these sanctuaries and tossed into trucks and blood splattered pews. And it was just a very, very horrific day for a lot of people here in Sri Lanka.
Who are these victims? We understand 290 have been confirmed deceased so far. Do we know ages, nationalities? Do we have any of their stories yet?
Yes, their stories are starting to come out, but actually authorities haven't released any victims' names or any identifying information. But a number of countries have claimed some of the deceased. We know that several Americans were among the dead. There were also people from Denmark, from Japan, from the UK, and several other countries. And in all, there were 39 foreign tourists who are said to be among the nearly 300 dead. So the rest of the people, the bulk of the people, were Sri Lankans. And their stories are coming out a bit more slowly, but from what witnesses and survivors are telling us, these are mainly church-going people who had arrived, for Mass or for to celebrate Easter and were with their families. And what we're afraid to find out is that, and what we're fearing is that in a lot of cases, there will be a lot of people, a lot of families who've been devastated by this incident, because families were together in these churches.
Yeah. What have law enforcement officials said about the people, the group behind this attack? I understand 24 people or so have been arrested so far. What do we know?
Right. So they haven't said much about the 24 people who they've taken into custody. They announced that earlier today on Monday, but then later this afternoon, they came out and said that these attacks were perpetrated by 7 suicide bombers, and they were able to determine that from forensic evidence at the scene. And they said that these suicide bombers were connected to this very little known domestic group called National Tawfiq Jamaat, And we're still very much trying to figure out what we can about this group, but very little has been documented on them. All authorities would say when they announced this group's name was that it had appeared in some intelligence briefings and some intelligence reports that started coming earlier this month warning about the potential of an attack. So we don't know in what context this group was mentioned, but we do know that in intelligence reports warning that there might be an attack, this group was mentioned.
I'm speaking with Emily Schmall, a correspondent covering South Asia for the Associated Press. She's in Sri Lanka reporting on the terror attacks on Easter Sunday. As you mentioned, there are members of the government who have spoken about tip-offs that law enforcement and other agencies may have had before this attack. Has there been any reaction directly from the prime minister or the president about the idea that the government knew there was an attack planned but didn't take steps to stop it?
Yeah, so the prime minister has made some sort of guarded criticisms of the intelligence in Sri Lanka, but it's a bit of a complicated story that goes back about 6 months to when the president of Sri Lanka decided to oust the prime minister and also dissolve the cabinet. Now, the Supreme Court of Sri Lanka later reversed these actions, but they've exposed this very bitter rivalry between these two men, the president and the prime minister. And the incident this weekend just further exposed the relative instability and the dysfunction at the highest levels of Sri Lanka's government because of the inability of these two men really to talk. So what the government said today was that somehow these intelligence reports never made it to the desk of the prime minister, so that the prime minister and his government were not made aware of the threat of an attack until after this massacre actually happened.
Is there a suggestion that that dysfunction in government could have led to a breakdown in communication on these issues?
Well, certainly people are questioning that, including the Archbishop of Colombo, who, of course, lost a lot of parishioners on Sunday, saying, you know, really, if there was some lapse in communication here, there really needs to be some justice paid, because if lives could have been saved but weren't because there was this failure to share intelligence, that's really a problem. So far, there's been no, you know, sort of formal complaint or action taken. Instead, in fact, both the president and prime minister sort of got behind a new development, which is that the military of Sri Lanka, for the first time really since the country's civil war came to an end about a decade ago, was just given police powers, very expansive police powers, to detain and arrest any suspects. So while there's a curfew on in Sri Lanka right now until early morning on Tuesday, at midnight local time here, the military will assume these new powers, which, again, they haven't had since wartime. And it will allow them to potentially pick up anyone they consider a suspect. So at least in the capital, people are still very much on edge and unsure of whether the danger has passed.
Yeah, certainly. Emily Schmall, correspondent covering South Asia for the Associated Press, with me from Sri Lanka. Finally, Emily, the National Tawhid Jamaat group that you mentioned, it's been connected with these attacks. It's an Islamic group, and this was an attack, obviously, majority targeting Christians. Is that typical of violence that has been happening in Sri Lanka over the past years and decades? Is it normal to have Christians a target of religious violence in Sri Lanka?
No, actually, it's not. And I think that's what really stunned the Christians of Sri Lanka. While there have been isolated incidents over the years, there was actually a civil war, but that was fought by the ethnic Tamil people against some segments of the ethnic Tamil people trying to establish independence from the Buddhist majority government.
And Tamil people are largely Hindu, I understand.
Tamil people are actually Hindu, Muslim, and Christian. So Sri Lanka is a Buddhist majority country, but has sizable Muslim, Hindu, and Christian minorities. But Christians are the fewest in Sri Lanka, and there really have never been certainly no large-scale attacks on Christians as we saw this weekend. So it's very unusual, and I think that's why nobody's really come out and said exactly what may have motivated this group, because it's really unprecedented.
Anything else that we should know about what's occurring in Sri Lanka right now, Emily? Anything that stands out to you? I know the government has imposed a social media blackout in addition to its other steps following the attacks.
That's right. And that's a really interesting point. And this isn't the first time that Sri Lanka has imposed this kind of social media blackout. And it's not complete. For example, you and I are talking on Skype and Twitter is still up and running, but most Sri Lankans won't have any access to WhatsApp or Facebook or Instagram. The government is saying that this is intended to sort of curb the flow of false information and rumors. But of course, I think it also signals that a country like Sri Lanka of 21 million people doesn't entirely trust American companies will act responsibly in an event of this kind of tragedy and this kind of scale.
The suggestion is that there would be false information, rumors, things that could be damaging going around on social media following an attack?
Yeah, they haven't explicitly said so. But I mean, if you just look to neighboring India, where there have been there's been clear violence that's been incited by misinformation, false information spread on social media, namely WhatsApp. And India itself is always grappling with this problem. So I think some of its smaller neighbors are looking to India and agreeing that to a certain extent, government should step in and regulate or try to control and try to dampen the spread of false information in times when false information could be used to incite violence against another person.
Emily Schmall, correspondent with the Associated Press. She's in Sri Lanka covering the devastating terror attacks of Easter Sunday. Thank you, Emily, for joining us on Air Talk here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Also on the line with us is Reverend Shanta Premavardhana, president of Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership, a global leadership training and consulting program serving religious and civic leaders. Welcome, Shanta. Thank you so much for being on Air Talk. And first, your reaction to these horrific attacks over the weekend.
First of all, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity. The attacks took us all by surprise yesterday morning, of course, and clearly a sense of shock and disbelief at the sheer scale of the attacks. And many of us who know these places, who know the cities and who know some of these locations where the churches were and the hotels, in fact, were really shocked to hear of what happened here. That shock has not abated much yet because we worry that, you know, this thing may not be over. There have been so many other detonations that you heard Emily talk about just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and I just want to make a note that you are Sri Lankan American, and so when you say you know these places, these must be, you know, areas you've either visited or you have family in the area. You know, it just must be a very emotional time for the Sri Lankan diaspora around the world. My question has to do with the context of these attacks. I was aware of a Sri Lankan civil war, you know, 10 years ago, and Emily mentioned the Tamil Tigers separatist group. That ended, however, and I'm curious what the history behind this really complicated religious tension that seems to have developed and resulted in these violent acts. Can you give us a sense of that history that led to something like these Easter attacks that happened on Sunday?
I will try to do that in a short period.
I know it's very difficult because there is so much nuance.
I think what is important to know that Sri Lanka has several religious and ethnic groups. Primary among them, the ethnic groups are Sinhala and Tamil. Also Muslim and Berger and Malay and so forth. Among the religions, Buddhists are primarily Sinhalese. Hindus are primarily Tamils. And Christians are both Sinhalese and Tamils. And Muslims belong to a variety of ethnic groups, but are thought more of as an ethno-religious grouping. What's important to know is that back in 1956, shortly after independence in 1948, there was a conflation of Sinhala Buddhist identity. So the ethnicity and religion came together that created, I think it was a lethal mix, which then excluded all of the others, Sinhala Christians, Tamils, Tamil Hindus, Tamil Christians, and Muslims were all excluded from that Sinhala Buddhist priority. Sri Lanka has a constitution that gives religious freedom to everybody, except it gives primacy of place to Buddhism. And therefore, they're sort of the first among equals. So therefore, the opportunity for discrimination against Tamils was quite rife during that period. And in fact, there were many agitations to create a federal state in the 1950s and 60s. But since those things didn't seem to be coming forward, there was an extremist group that arose within the Tamil community seeking a separate state. That is the what we call the Tamil Tigers. That conflict went on from about 1983 to 2009, very long time, 26 years. But since 2009, that's 10 years ago, there has been a ceasefire. So that's the short history of that conflict.
Yeah.
However, you had minority Muslims and minority Christians, and we've all got along quite well for most of the time. But from time to time, there have been attacks on the minority community.
We did just hear from Emily that this kind of attack, it does not have a lot of precedent. The attack on Christians by a Muslim Islamic group. You're saying that there is some incident of minority on minority violence, but it's not common.
Yeah, she is right. Christians have not received violence from Muslims, at least not much. Neither has it happened the other way around. But it is from extremist groups within the Buddhist community that minority religious communities have received violence. Just as an example, one year ago, in March of 2018, we had a situation where several villages, primarily Muslim villages, were attacked by mobs that were incited by some Buddhist monks who have created a more violent group of people who were creating this kind of violence. So violent extremism is not foreign to Buddhism, but unfortunately. Muslims and Christians have been in the forefront of receiving that.
Just because we are up against a break, but I know that this is a deeply personal and significant set of issues that you're speaking about. And just to reset, I am speaking with Reverend Shanta Premavardhana, who is the president of Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership. Anything else that you want to add that people should know about this conflict in Sri Lanka, this attack and its context, and whether, as you mentioned, that there may be more violence?
Well, let us hope not. The context has been what I described, but Buddhists and Christians and Muslims and Hindus have a long history of working together. My organization, in fact, creates interfaith peacemaker teams in order that we would bring people of different religions so that they can work together. And they've done so in the areas where last year we had some of the violence against Muslims. Sri Lanka is a really fascinating country for a variety of reasons, including the fact that we have so many religious communities that are working together.
Reverend Shanta, I do have to break. I'm so sorry to cut our conversation short, but I hope to continue it in the future. And I do thank you so much for representing the diaspora of Sri Lankan Americans today on Air Talk, Reverend Shanta Premavardhana with the Omnia Institute. Thank you very much for joining Air Talk.
Thank you very much.
It is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman sitting in for Larry Mantle. Coming up, we're going to discuss youth sports and the expectations that parents have when their children engage in athletic endeavors. And I want to take your calls after this very short break. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Dankman here with you in for Larry Mantle for one more day. So what are the expectations that come with seeing your kid compete on the court or the field? The Wall Street Journal reports that only 2% of high school athletes will receive college scholarships in their sport. And that's according to the National Collegiate Athletic Association. And that includes awards well short of the full ride that many parents covet. In some cases, athletes receive just a few thousand dollars to put toward tuition, housing, and other expenses. But parents don't really seem to realize that those odds are so slim. Many parents, at least, that spoke with TD Ameritrade, who surveyed parents in 2019, 40% of those parents felt confident that their kid would get an athletic scholarship. They were even willing to go into financial debt or delay retirement to help fund their kid's sports career. I would love to hear from parents and athletes themselves. What expectations did you have playing youth sports? Did you believe that you were investing in a future that involved a college scholarship or other types of rewards in the future? Were there coaches or other athletic officials that gave you that impression that a college scholarship was around the corner? Are there any parents who did indeed experience financial stress funding their kids' elite sports activities? We know that they can get very expensive. I was an athlete in my youth and traveled all over playing soccer. And I just know that my parents spent a pretty penny on coaching fees and all kinds of equipment, the new sweats that we all had to have for the team. 866-893-5722 is the call-in number if you want to weigh in on Air Talk. 866-893-5722. You can also go to our Air Talk page at kpcc.org or, of course, the Facebook page or tweet us at Air Talk. I'm at LIBDENK, LibDank. With me now on the line is Kiki Baker-Barnes, Athletic Director at Dillard University in New Orleans. Welcome, Kiki, to Air Talk.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here today.
What's your reaction when you hear about a survey like this that shows that many parents of athletes, youth athletes, believe that their children will go on to get college scholarships? And what is the reality of the types of scholarships you're able to offer, for example, at Dillard University?
Well, I can tell you this is absolutely correct. I frequently go out and watch young people play. I have a son and a daughter who played some youth sports, and so I had the opportunity to sit with other parents, and I hear them talk about full scholarships and these opportunities for colleges. I've gone to speak at local schools, and one of the things you'll hear coaches say is these scholarships are available. But let me tell you, the reality is that the athletic scholarship budget at most institutions may be less than 5% of their overall scholarship budget. And so one of the things that I share when I have the opportunity to talk to parents or to young people about the opportunities is to stress the importance of academic success and doing very well, and that if you also have academic success and some athletic success, then you may have a better shot at being able to cover the full cost for college. Dillard University is a member of the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, NAIA, and so we have some full scholarships, but most of the scholarship offers that we have are partial. And so one of the other things that I see is that we'll have parents who are only looking for NCAA Division I.
Oh, sure. You want to go straight to the top, right?
Yeah, but there are so many other opportunities. There's NCAA Division II, which also offers athletic scholarships. The NAIA offers athletic scholarships. There's also the National Junior College Athletic Association, NJCAA, where you can go to a two-year school and get a scholarship potentially to play and then transfer in two more years to a four-year. So there are other opportunities out there. I just think sometimes they're only thinking about the Division I level.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes it's just parents being aware that there are other associations and other levels other than NCAA Division I.
866-893-5722 to weigh in about your expectations when your kid competed in athletics. Did you see other parents who were just very sure that their children would go on to big scholarship money for athletics in college, and, you know, whether they made it or not? Was there an expectation in your sports programs that that would be the result? And so the investment that you made in time and in finances was all going to be worth it because of this financial reward at the end of the rainbow. Also on the line is Lisa Delpy Narati, a director of the Master's in Sports Management Program and Associate Professor of Sports Management at George Washington University in D.C. Lisa, your reaction to this survey that showed, well, only 2% of athletes will ever get a college scholarship for athletics. We are talking about 40% of parents, according to a survey, that believe their kids will eventually get that scholarship.
Right. We all think our children are excellent. And, you know, in their little microcosm, they are. They may be the best on their team, but they're competing with not only domestic students from across the country, but international students as well, especially for those non-revenue sports and tennis and volleyball and fencing. So there is a lot of competition out there. And the statistics are not surprising that it's only 2%.
Yeah. We just have to take a quick break right now. Lisa Delpy Narati with George Washington University and Kiki Baker-Barnes with me of Dillard University in New Orleans. We're going to be right back with this conversation and your calls, 866-893-5722 to weigh in, or on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, Facebook, Twitter. You can reach us any way you'd like. I'd love to get your calls right after this break. And we're going to news with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. We're talking about youth sports, your expectations for a kid, or if you were an athlete in high school thinking you would go on to a college scholarship. Did you put finances into that endeavor? Did you spend a lot of money on traveling teams and equipment only to find out that the number of college scholarships that are actually given out for athletics is very low, 2% according to the data that we have on hand? And a recent survey showed that the understanding of that is not widespread. Parents believe, 40% of them at least that spoke with Ameritrade, that their kids will eventually be rewarded with college scholarships if they play at the competitive level at the youth age group. Nikki from Compton said, I was a college athlete and went to college on a full ride scholarship. And as the parent of two athletes and a coach of high school sports, I encourage students to seek out multiple scholarships, both athletic and academic. Nikki says, I have every bit of faith in my students to accomplish their athletic and academic goals. Bill, writing on the AirTalk page, he said that wouldn't parents be better served by putting that money into a investment account and, you know, really trying to grow that nest egg in order to spend on college later rather than spending it on expensive sports teams, expensive equipment. Grace in Culver City also writing in, has the recent college admission scandal had an impact on all of this? That's a great question, Grace, and I want to turn to my guests to talk about that. Lisa Delpy Narati is on the line with George Washington University, director of the Master's in Sports Management program. I'm curious, Lisa, if you have seen a broader conversation about sports, college athletics, the way that scholarships are given out or admissions are given out in the wake of that admissions scandal. I'm sure it's been top of mind in a lot of programs nationwide.
Right. I mean, it's well known that there is special consideration for special talent, and special talent in this purpose is athletic talent. And, you know, there's people who kind of count on that. They still, it's so competitive these days to get into the top tier universities. And you could have the perfect GPA and a perfect SAT, and what else is it going to take to get in? And so, again, they're relying on their athletic talent to make that difference. But for those unique sports, there's so few spots. And again, they could take both domestic or international, and you have to be the, you know, the cream of the crop to get that. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, parents enjoy this experience of going to games and getting a recognition that, you know, association with their kids. And so sometimes it's the parents that are chasing the dreams as much as the youth.
Yeah, that just seems like a natural extension, especially if you love the sport and you want to see your child succeed. It becomes also a personal thing for you. It is realizing maybe something that you fell short in your own life, or just really wishing that you had followed that path. I think that that's an understandable impulse for parents. Kiki Baker-Barnes on the line from Dillard University. I'm curious what you think about the college admission scandal. It was a big deal, of course, in Southern California, with USC parents being indicted on their manipulation of the admissions system and potentially facing some jail time for that. Has there been a wider conversation about sports, athletics, admissions in your community as an athletic director at Dillard University since that scandal broke?
Well, I'll tell you, I certainly see conversation in my affinity groups with other athletic professionals across the country about ethics and standards. You know, the reason that they were able to pull off such a scandal was because there were people on the inside, coaches and administrators inside who agreed to participate, which I must say, I was like, wow, like, this is very unethical and goes against the standards of the work that we do. And so there's been questions and conversation around what that looks like and what our responsibilities are for and to and whom we actually work for. And so a lot of the conversation has been there. The NAIA level, the smaller levels, NCAA Division II, Division III, NAIA, junior college, we don't see that kind of I don't know, as much of that kind of action.
Nobody's ever offered you a major lump of money to get somebody in on an athletic admission, Kiki. You haven't experienced that?
Absolutely not. and maybe because we don't have the same offer. One of the things is those fluoride offers are available at the highest level, and you're not necessarily getting those opportunities at the NCAA Division II, Division III, NAIA. Even though if you work hard and you apply for the scholarships, you can get a fluoride offer or a package is what is the kind of terminology we use. At our level, we give you a financial aid package where we can limit the amount of out-of-pocket expenses that may occur for a parent. But that would include Pell Grant and some other merit scholarships that may be available. We have a number of alumni chapters who have endowed scholarships for students that may be from California. We have a large California population here at Dillard.
I bet you do. 866-893-5722 is the number to weigh in on this issue of expectations. As an athlete or as a parent of an athlete, did you think that your kid was going to go on to get a college scholarship, or do you see that perception in youth sports today? Bob from Torrance wrote in saying that he was a high school coach for multiple sports for 30 years. The number of kids whose parents drove them to be, quote, champions was ridiculous. These parents had such tunnel vision, they sucked all the fun out of the sport their kid was playing, put a lot of unneeded pressure on them to succeed, win. A recent survey by TD Ameritrade said 40% of youth sport parents believe their kid will get a college scholarship for athletics, but the reality is only 2% do. Your calls, 866-893-5722, and more with our guests after a quick break. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. Hey there, it's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk today. Larry will be back tomorrow. Thanks for sticking with me while he is away. Andy from Irvine wrote in on our youth sports topic saying he played club soccer in high school, then played for Humboldt State on a scholarship. But even if he didn't get offered a scholarship, Andy says he thinks he would have been it would have been worth his time and money that he and his family invested, because sports builds positive characteristics in youth, like a sense of community with teammates and leadership skills. So there are separate incentives, what Andy is saying, rather than just saying, I'm going to get paid off by getting a college scholarship in the future. I certainly think that's why my parents invested time and money in my sister and I playing a lot of soccer. We were under no illusions that either one of us was going to be a college athlete, but we did play club level soccer and traveled around quite a bit. Lisa Delby Narati, I think about this survey that TD Ameritrade did showing that many parents were willing to, say, put off retirement or go into credit card debt in order to fund their youth athletes' activities, and the expectation that they would eventually get money for college is there. Do you think that there is an unhealthy understanding of the reason that kids should play sports? Andy is saying it just should go back to the basics, that this is great for character and team building.
I completely agree that parents need to be better informed and educated to let the kids be kids and to play, because you'll have fewer people dropping out. The reason most children drop out of sports is because it's no fun anymore. It's become so competitive, and then the parents are always yelling at them. But there's so much good from playing sports. I mean, there was the discussion of, you know, leadership and character development, but learning to fail. You know, there's a whole series recently on youth being soft these days, you know, because they're all protected over, well, don't let Susie, you know, get upset. Or
yeah, the helicopter parent philosophy, so, sort of, yeah.
In sports, there's always a winner, a loser, and you have to learn to lose. And that, you know, builds character. There's also the whole friendship part. I mean, so much, you know, today's with, you know, emotional learning and mental health, you know, having friends around you in that social environment is also very positive for youth, as long as they're not going to be, you know, picked on or felt like they're the last man chosen from the bench. So, you know, sports can be very positive, but if it's not in the right environment and you don't have the right coaches and people around you, then it could be negative as well.
Sure. Frank in Pasadena is on the line. Frank, what do you have to say about this issue of parents expecting their kids to excel in sports in order to get a college scholarship?
Yeah, great show. Just two quick points. The first one is that I grew up as one of these kids where my parents really pushed me to get some type of scholarship to be able to go to school. And I realized early on in my high school career that just wasn't going to happen. I couldn't put in the time and be able to balance academics. And I just really found myself in a position where I was being tired the entire time and it couldn't work.
Yeah.
The point was that I still have family who are doing that, doing this to their children. And they're pushing the idea that sports is a vehicle to be able to get that college scholarship. And it happens quite often that they, you know, they reach the year, you know, they reach 18 years old and it's just a few months out till graduation and they're still waiting for that phone call. That's probably never going to happen. And most likely is not going to happen.
You bring up an important point too, Frank, that the time that it takes as a high school student to also play high level sports, you're on a club team normally, not just the high school team. I had two-a-day practices many times during my high school career, many days where, you know, two-a-day practices would then turn into hours of homework at night because you still have to maintain your GPA. This is a major commitment of time, and the expectations heaped on top don't make it any easier.
Definitely. Definitely an issue that I still see a lot of students who attempt to go to college still struggle with right now. You know, what do I do after sports are over?
Yeah, Frank in Pasadena, thanks very much for your call. Kiki Baker Barnes, do you get parents emailing you asking for scholarship money or inquiring about scholarship money? And is it often a conversation that you have to disappoint them about? You're the athletic director at Dillard University, just to reset.
Yes, I frequently get emails about parents. Like, I recently received one saying that we thank you for the offer, but that's still going to leave us with the balance of this amount. We're trying to see if there's any more money available. And unfortunately, you know, I had to share with her that the offer that the coach, you know, has given is his final offer, but then I'll refer them to our university's financial aid office and the page where we have a lot of other external scholarships that they can apply for to help cover that gap. I often have those conversations even on visits. We have, you know, families that come down to visit the school because, of course, they want to see if this is going to be a good fit. And when I have conversations with parents, I have to have that honest conversation about what financially it looks like being an athlete here and attending school and what the expectations would look like and what those opportunities look like for them. Even if they didn't decide to attend Dillard University and wanted to go to another institution, you know, just trying to provide the education. I think our other guest mentioned earlier that parents need to be more educated. So I kind of see my role sometimes as doing some of that throughout the process for them.
Yeah, that outreach, that education, setting expectations early, because 40% of parents expecting their kids to get a scholarship versus 2% the reality that will get a scholarship is really a shocking disparity there. Lisa Delpy-Narati, anything else you want to add to this conversation about college scholarships, athletics, parents' expectations, all of it?
Yes, parents also know that once those students do get that scholarship, it's, you know, it's a tough road ahead. It's like a full-time job, as everybody's been talking to. And I always find it so surprising. They're like, oh, this is just so hard for my kids. I said, what do you think? You're getting a full ride, or, you know, not always getting a full ride. But, you know, if you're a scholarship athlete or any, you know, any athlete at a university level, even at Division, you know, two, they expect a lot of the athletes.
Oh, you know, there is an email that's come in that I wanted to share along these lines. Jim from Los Feliz saying his 14-year-old son is a talented shortstop in Little League, and we've been told he has potential to get a college scholarship, but Jim is concerned that if he went to school on an athletic scholarship, it would be too difficult to balance academics and athletics. And what I'm hearing you say, Lisa Delpy-Narati, is this is a real concern, that this is an extra pile of work on top of what you already are expected to do in school.
You can do it. Many do and, you know, are very successful, but it's not easy. And I think, you know, athletes need to go into, you know, the university, and parents have to understand this too, that it is very, you've got to have great time management, and you have to, you know, forgive some things. Like, you're not going to be able to do, you know, study abroad oftentimes, and you're not going to be able to join a sorority or fraternity most of the time. So, you know, there are things you have to compromise for that.
Yeah, everything is balance. Everything is a sacrifice. Lisa Delpy-Narati with George Washington University, thank you very much for joining the conversation. Also, Kiki Baker-Barnes of Dillard University in New Orleans, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle will be back tomorrow. I'm Libby Denkman. Thank you so much for sticking with me while Larry is away. Fresh Air is coming up next.